This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, welcome back. This is the place where you... One thing you can be guaranteed of is unpredictable conversations, that's for sure. 888-914-9149 is the number to dial, 888-914-9149. You may remember the name Lena Wen. Does that name ring a bell to you, Lena Wen? Lena Wen was the, I refer to her affectionately as the Queen of Corpse Mountain, insofar as she was, for a relatively short period of time, she was the head of Planned Parenthood, but she was forced out. And the former Queen of Corpse Mountain was there for quite a long time. But in any case, so Lena Wen, she's now kind of an expert. She's a medical doctor. And she's an expert who shows up regularly on CNN and ABC and such. And she recently talked about what happened. You know, how come you were the Queen of Corpse Mountain, a.k.a. Planned Parenthood, but not for a very long time. And the next thing you know, you were... ousted, or so it seemed, and, you know, what happened? So this, by the way, is an article by Emily Zanotti, and this is from the Daily Wire, so check them out. Former head of Planned Parenthood, Dr. Lena Wen, was forced to part ways with the women's health provider, and that's in quotation marks, because she did not promote abortion enough in public interviews, according to her new book. The organization also wanted Wen to use a miscarriage that she had suffered just before she left her post at Planned Parenthood as her public excuse for stepping down just 9 months with the organization, according to Business Insider. I mean, think about this for a second. This is me speaking. An organization that's willing to cut to pieces helpless unborn children, do you think it's, you know, do you think they wouldn't stoop that low to try to encourage this woman to lie about why she really left? Of course they would. Back to the article. On her first full day on the job as Planned Parenthood's president, Dr. Lena Wen appeared on ABC's The View to talk about her vision for the organization, according to Business Insider, who's quoting this now. When the segment wrapped, Wen, who had left her role as Baltimore's health commissioner for the gig, was elated that it had resonated with the live cheering audience, but her new colleagues at Planned Parenthood's headquarters were not. Because why? Because Wen had failed to say the word abortion. In fact, Wen says she was expected by Planned Parenthood to promote abortion, which the clinic chain claims makes up just 3% of its services every time she appeared in public. So I'm going to stop there for a second. This is part of the big lie that Planned Parenthood loves to perpetrate. Because on the one hand, they don't want the bad rap that, oh, you guys are all about abortion. That's all you really do is abortion. They'll say, oh, no, no, we have all kinds of, you know, women's health things that we do. And they make up this rigmarole about having abortion is only 3% of the total services. And the good people over at Live Action, they came up with a great response to that, showing that this is a farce and that, you know, it'd be like going into a restaurant and, you know, a steak restaurant, and they say, well, steak is really only 3% of what we do here. And they would count the salt and the pepper and the steak sauce and the fork and the knife and the spoon and the plate and the cup and the table, all of those as if they were different parts of what they did. It's a steakhouse. That's what you get when you go to a steakhouse. You get steak. It's not 3% of their business. It's their business. So that's the backdrop here. That on the one hand, Planned Parenthood, they're scamming people left and right by telling them, well, abortion is only 3% of our services. But Dr. Lena Wen herself, who was for 9 months, and isn't that an interesting period of time? 9 months as the Queen of Corpse Mountain, as I affectionately refer to her. And she said, no, the reason that I got sacked is because I didn't talk enough about abortion. That's what they want. They want abortion. They want a lot of abortion. Give us the abortions, they say. So, Dr. Lena Wen was given an ultimatum. Change your strategy as president of Planned Parenthood or leave. The emergency physician and former Baltimore health commissioner had tried to position the organization as a nonpartisan healthcare institution, but its board wanted to double down on its progressive pro-abortion advocacy. So these are excerpts from her interview and also how her position was being described. You need to talk about abortion at every media interview, Wen says she was told by a Planned Parenthood staffer. And I probably am not saying it in an annoying voice the way that staffer probably did. You need to talk about abortion at every media interview, Lena. Come on. You're the president of Planned Parenthood. People expect that from you. Not saying abortion sounds as if you're ashamed of it. That's what she's saying. If we don't talk about abortion openly, loudly, and proudly as a positive moral good, then we are further stigmatizing it and the people who need it. That's what she was told. Wen believed that Planned Parenthood should approach the issue of abortion with more care, believing using pro-abortion language alienated people whose decision to get one was painful. Now, you notice that they can't even bring themselves to say women. I'm sorry, Emily. It's not your fault. The people who get abortions are women. FYI. Let's see. Wen believed that they believed, she said that they believed, using pro-abortion language alienated people. And so Planned Parenthood wanted to be more attuned. Lena Wen wanted to be more attuned to people whose views on abortion were nuanced and focus more on abortion providers' other services. What ultimately led to her departure was the realization that Planned Parenthood was more concerned with its political advocacy than providing actual health care to women. Wen said, and this is a quote from the interview, a quote by those who interviewed her, Wen said, ultimately, the tension between her and those around her wasn't just about abortion, but about politics. This is Business Insider quoting this. Planned Parenthood sees itself as a liberal advocacy organization outspoken on issues loosely related to health care, like net neutrality, defending the police, and the statehood for the District of Columbia. So she said, I was given a choice, change or leave. While Wen was deciding whether to give up her position, she suffered a miscarriage. When she confided in a colleague what had happened, the colleague told her higher-ups, who then suggested she use the loss to explain her departure. In other words, lie about why she left. After she refused, Planned Parenthood's board voted her out, a decision that she says she learned about over text messages from a news organization. The former head of Planned Parenthood says she is still supportive of the organization's mission. I'll just let that slide by without a comment. I think you know what I'm thinking, right? 888-914-9149. Let's go to Paula now in Wisconsin. Hi, Paula.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Yes. Welcome.
Hi. Hi. I just had a question. My daughter is 18 now, and she, for the last few years, has struggled with depression and anxiety, kind of worsening, becoming more and more withdrawn. We sent her to a counselor for about a year, and then that counselor didn't feel like she was getting anywhere. So she went to intensive inpatient therapy for the last few weeks. There she was diagnosed with gender dysphoria, which we kind of knew she was, based on what things she said and that things her sister said, that she was struggling with her gender identity. Mm-hmm. And now she says she's non-binary.
Tell you what, Paul, I'm going to put you on hold. And they're going to get you sorted out. We'll figure out what the problem is with the audio, and I'll come back to you, okay? So stand by. Let's go to Aaron right now.
I have a question for you. I am in the middle of reading, just began reading a book called Lex Orandi, or Oriandi by Daniel Graham, comparing traditional and the Novus Ordo rites. And muddling through it, there's a part of it that says Father Bugnini,
Annibale Bugnini.
Bugnini. He was in charge of coming up or forming the Novus Ordo Rite, and it said that he employed or had the help of other, like, Protestant representatives to do that. And I'm just trying to figure out what is really true, or I don't know if okay. you're familiar with that.
I am very familiar with this. Very, very, very okay. familiar. Okay, so first, I don't know that book, so I can't give you a thumbs up or down on it, but let me refer you to a book that I have read. I mean, it's one of several that I've read on the topic, and it's quite good. It's called Annibale Bunini, Reformer of the Liturgy, and the author is Yves Chiron. I don't know if he pronounces it Chiron or Chiron, but it's C-H-I-R-O-N. And this is an accurate and very clear history of the role that Annibale Bunini played in. At first, he was sort of like a secretary, and he helped to shepherd a lot of the meetings and papers and speeches that were given in the liturgical reform movement in Europe in the decades leading up to the Second Vatican Council. So he was very active behind the scenes. Now, when it got time for the council, so this was convened by Pope John the 23rd, and then he died shortly after that, and so it was presided over by Pope Paul the 6th. What this book does, what Yves Chiron does, is he shows meticulously the role that Bunini played in convincing Pope Paul the 6th to accept certain ideological demands in some cases, but also suggestions about the reform of the liturgy. So if you want a thorough and accurate depiction of his role, this is the book for you. Now, another book that I would recommend was written at the time of the council. It's called The Rhine Flows into the Tiber. It's published by Tan Books. And the author, Father Ralph Wilkin, was a trained journalist, an American. And so he was working in Rome in his capacity as a journalist to provide the ongoing reports from the council to the English-speaking world and primarily to the United States. So this book that he wrote is a distillation of his experience being there, who said what, who did what, when did this happen, etc. And that, too, is a very helpful book. And I think the two together will give you a great deal of insight. There is a lot of speculation about, was Annibale Bunini, was he a Freemason? Was he actively trying to destroy the church by the things he was doing? Now, there's room for discussion on both sides of that issue. I think he was definitely not a benign character, but he also wasn't the Antichrist the way very many people make him out to be. But I would say if I had to put him in one category or the other, it would be definitely in a negative category because of the influence that he exercised. But what his personal motivations were, it's hard to tell. But between those two books, and I'm not saying that the book you're reading now is not a good book, I just have never read it. But those two books I have read, and I think you'll find them very enlightening. Does that help?
Well, yeah, that helps a lot. I'm just looking at it. I have a brother and his wife and children go to a Latin Rite parish mm-hmm. that's actually maybe a little bit out there with, they believe the chair of St. Peter is empty at this point, that kind mm-hmm. of thing.
And if I were them, I would stay far away from that because that's a sede contest group.
And they bring a point such as this, of what to do or mm-hmm. what has happened in the past. And, and I just want what I want is just the facts. And
well, I can tell you what their thesis is, Aaron. You probably have heard this from them. Their thesis is that the Mass is invalid. And that there, and not only is it invalid, but it's diabolical, they'll say. And they say this, too, about the other sacraments of the church, with the exception of baptism. And they'll say that they probably would tell you that Pope Pius XII was the last valid pope. They might say Pope Pius XI, but most Sede Vacantists would mark it at Pope Pius XII, and that every so-called pope since then has been invalid. And they would argue that thus the sacraments are invalid as well. I wouldn't pay that any never mind. Pay that no never mind,
right.
as they
say. And I don't, but I just, I think with where the church is at today and some of the issues we face, and sometimes I go to a mass and whoever is the priest in charge of the mass, saying the mass, you look at it and go, okay, was that really a mass? You know, they vary so differently today sometimes.
Are you becoming infected with their mindset, Aaron? Let me ask you that bluntly.
No, not at all. I've wondered about it for a long time, mm-hmm. but then they change, you know, they go to this Latin Rite, and I'm not...
No, I understand. I'm just saying for your purposes, for you personally, are you finding this troubling you, or are you just wanting to know more about what happened?
No, just to know what happened. What are some of the actual things that happened and why and where we can go forward as a mm-hmm. Catholic Church, you know?
Yes. Well, there are other books I could recommend to you, some of which are very critical of the new Mass. Iota Unum, for example. By, Antonio Romero? I'm forgetting the author's name, but that's a tome. That's a probably 600-page book that deals exclusively with this.
Yeah, I need a simpler.
that's what I thought. So, I mean, I don't want to throw everything but the kitchen sink at you, but I think these two books I mentioned first would be helpful to you. They're not partisan. That's the nice thing. It's not taking a partisan view. It's just trying to give you history unfiltered so that you can draw your own conclusions.
And that's what I would appreciate, because this Lex Orandi, I think it leans more towards how the traditional Latin Mass is the deal, mm-hmm. and it shouldn't have ever, you know, and the sacraments. It goes mm-hmm. over the beginning to go over the sacraments, just like you had mentioned.
Right. You know what I'd suggest? I've got to press on, but Catholic Answers has done great work in the area of responding to Sede Vacantist arguments over time. So if you go to Catholic.com, you can type that phrase in, Sede Vacantism or Sede Vacantist, and their articles and other resources will come up, and that would also provide you with a lot more background. Because it is a difficult topic, I grant you that. It's difficult. It's many faceted. There are many nuances and details of history that are part of this bigger picture. But anyway, that would be my suggestion. Thank you for the call. I hope that's helpful to you. Let's go back to Paula now. Paula, I hope we got your audio sorted out. Welcome back.
Can you hear me now? Or
Yes.
Yes, great. Okay, so my 18-year-old daughter suffers from depression and anxiety. It's kind of been worsening over the last few years. She's now in an intensive outpatient program, and during this time met with a psychiatrist and has been diagnosed with gender dysphoria. She has, you know, in talking to her, she struggled for a number of years, doesn't feel she fits to the female, doesn't feel like a female, but she doesn't feel like a male, so she wants to be identified now as non-binary and use the pronouns they and them. And I've had the discussion with her about, you know, the, how can that be, you know, that God made us male and female and you're born a female. How can you say you're not a female? And I'm not getting anywhere with her. And I didn't know if there's any information you could give me to help explain the Catholic view or.
Thankfully, there is. Thankfully, there is. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, I'm really sorry to hear that you're in this situation, but you know what, Paula, you're not alone. There are many other families who, much to their shock and sadness, are getting similar messages, especially from their daughters. It seems to be more women who are experiencing this than men, but that's just anecdotal. So yes, here are some references. If you have a pen, write these down, please. The first is a book by Abigail Schreier, S-H-R-I-E-R, called Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. It's very good, and I bought multiple copies to give to other people so that they can be helped by this.
Okay,
and I would recommend you get it before Amazon takes it down. I'm surprised it's still on there, but it's quite good. Okay, the second book is called When Harry Became Sally. You may remember the movie called When Harry, When Harry Met Sally. Well, this is a riff on that. It's by Dr. Ryan Anderson. It's called When Harry Became Sally. Now, that book takes up the question of the transgender issue across both male and female. The first book I recommended, Irreversible Damage, focuses primarily on women. And I think either or both of these books will give you a lot to go on. Now, I don't know whether or not you'll be able to get your daughter to read, for example, Irreversible Damage. But if she will read it, that would be helpful because it would speak to her at a clinical level, at an emotional and psychological level. It will give her a lot of things to think about. Now, if she won't read it, at least you can read it and assimilate the information and then share it with her. Now, okay. Maybe that's the best place to start, and maybe call me back in a month or so and let me know how that turned out.
Okay. Okay. That sounds great. I have the book and I started reading it. So 2 days I'm into it. So.
Oh, which book is that? You already have
Irreversible Damage. That's okay, the one I good. Have that I just started.
Well, you're off and running then, Paula. That's good. Okay, great. I'm going to hope for good things in this situation. God bless you and your daughter. I'll be right back with more right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
My friend Michael Knowles apparently mentioned me on his podcast over the weekend, or maybe it was Friday, I forget, because people all over the place were telling me, hey, did you hear Michael Knowles was talking about you? So shout out to Michael Knowles. Great guy. Really great guy. Devout Catholic. I met him and his wife for the first time several years ago, and he's an impressive young man. He's got a new book out, and if you're interested, he and I went out and got some tacos in L.A. not that long ago, and I posted a picture of me and Michael, standing in front of the entrance to the taco restaurant where we hung out that afternoon and ate tacos and had a great conversation. It wasn't the first time we hung out, but it was a lot of fun. So if you want to see Michael and myself at the taco joint, you'll see it on my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. Let's see. We're going to go now to another Michael in South Orange, New Jersey. What a coincidence. Hi, Michael. Welcome.
Yeah. So just circling back to an earlier topic about prayer, I had a question that's always been, a concern. So there's different forms of prayer, obviously, but I always wonder, because I do this a lot, just say internal prayers, whether they're, recited prayer or whether it's just a conversation or just a thought or a quick idea or whatever. And I was just wondering, is that heard? Is it equal to a verbal prayer? And I'm going to ask you to substantiate that in some way, or at least explain to me how it would work, because I do it a lot and I don't know if it's working.
So when you say you do it a lot, you mean just prayers that rise up from your heart in the moment?
Yeah, just internal, I say the prayer in, not unconsciously, but not verbally.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, obviously God does hear those things, and here's how you can know that, because God is infinite and anything that can be known, God knows. So the phenomenon of you thinking thoughts that come from your heart and your mind and you're addressing yourself to God, he absolutely does hear those. He knows exactly what you're thinking. Now, if you want substantiation, I'm not sure. Do you want like a Bible verse that says that? Is that what you're looking for? Or, I mean, I think just knowing the nature of God, I would think that'd be enough, just knowing that God knows everything.
Yeah, I feel that. I mean, sort of preconditioned to feel that, I guess. But there are verses where, where one or two are gathered in his presence, he's there. And, there's other verses about he hears you. But I don't know that I can find anything that suggests that he just, other than knowing my thoughts, if my thoughts are clearly directed to him, either in an inquisitive way or, praying for someone else, let's say, you know, is that as viable, for lack of a better word, than an audible prayer?
Yeah, there's no difference in terms of whether God can hear that or not, or whether he, you know, not that he doesn't hear it, but whether he'll respond to it. I think the real issue, or the real pivot point, Michael, is the person who's praying in the state of grace. So, or is the person who's praying desiring to be in the state of grace? So if somebody is a rank sinner who has no intention of turning away from his sin, and he's praying, oh, Lord, please help me get out of this traffic ticket, God doesn't hear those prayers, or we could maybe say he ignores those prayers. But those of a sinner or somebody who may be in the state of grace and is asking God, we know that God does listen to those prayers. But if you are in the latter category, it doesn't really matter ultimately how you pray, whether you're praying audibly or you're praying in your mind and not moving your lips. It doesn't matter whether you are praying a formula prayer or you're praying an extemporaneous prayer from the heart. God hears all of those things. And if you are sincerely turning toward him, it sounds like you are, then he will hear them, you know, proactively hear them, not just be aware of them.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, I do that a lot. And, you know, whether it's because you're just engaged in conversation with somebody else or you're involved with something, and I just always sort of step aside and mentally and do that. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if it was effective. I guess that was the question.
I would argue very much so. Yeah, very, very effective. And the more you love God and the more you're attentive to him, the more you'll feel the presence of, you know, the more you'll feel his presence, but also the more you will discern the way in which God answers your prayers. So, yeah. Have you ever read The Interior Mansion by St. Teresa of Avila?
Interior Mansion?
Yeah, it's a classic in the work of prayer. And just a quick summary, Michael, she describes how she uses the idea of mansions within mansions within mansions, a kind of concentric building, if you can think of it that way, where at the lowest level, the beginning level, you're not even quite inside the building yet. You're trying to get there, and you have to pass through this courtyard that's filled with creepy crawlies, you know, snakes and other dangerous things that try to stop you from coming into the mansion. And the mansion, of course, is the depth of prayer. That's what it's analogous to. And these creepy crawlies, these are distractions and temptations and other things that are the devil often uses to try to stop you from praying. But once you get into the mansion, then she describes how you move more and more into the center and how you can know that your prayer life is deepening. So she walks you through what we would call the discursive prayers, you know, the Our Father and the Hail Mary and prayers that we can all pray. And those are good. That's kind of the beginning. But the goal is to get to what's known as mental prayer, to move from discursive prayer. It doesn't mean you have to stop doing that, but to go beyond it to then into the area of meditation, which is a deeper form of prayer, and then ultimately to get to the deepest form of prayer, which is contemplation, where you're no longer saying things. You've reached the point where you are actually contemplating the Lord. You don't see him face to face, obviously, but you're contemplating the Lord and the things of the Lord, and there is a tremendous depth and power in that kind of mental prayer. So that book, I think, will really help you, as it's helped so many, in deepening your own prayer and moving into those interior mansions and getting more and more out of your prayer life. So that would be my suggestion, Michael. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Let's go to Preeti now, listening in Austin. Hi, Preeti.
Hi. I had a question regarding baptism.
Yes.
So my husband and I had a little baby girl in June.
Congratulations.
And one thing... Thank you very much. It's our first child, and I wasn't, I obviously had the desire or have the desire to get my child baptized. Mm-hmm. However, till last night, I did not really read the canon law, and I came across the rule, or like I came across what it said in the canon law that a child should be baptized as soon as possible or within the first weeks of life.
Right.
I'm used to baptism being more of a social event, and I didn't really understand or didn't really think about baptizing her without my parents or my husband's parents, because they live in mm-hmm. India. So the way that we had viewed it was this would be a nice thing for them to also be a part of. So we thought that maybe we'll wait for a few months. But after reading the canon law and where it says there's an obligation as parents to get the child baptized as soon as possible, especially right. To get her free from original sin, we are reconsidering our decision. And I thought I wanted to hear your take on this as well.
Sure. Yeah, I have a very strong point of view on this issue. Get your child baptized as soon as possible. Now, reasonably speaking, that would be the church in canon law, it says within the first few weeks. That's canon 867. So to my mind, that means within the first couple of weeks. So Nancy and I would always have our children baptized no later than about 2 weeks after they were born. And parents or babies are certainly capable of being baptized at that young age. The danger here, and this is why the church strongly encourages baptism as soon as possible, is because life being so unpredictable, it's entirely possible that a child could die without baptism, you know, sudden infant death syndrome, God forbid, or some other problem like that. So the rule of thumb is to have your child baptized as soon as possible. And now in the age of Zoom, just think, your relatives in India could be there virtually and watch the baptism on Zoom or on FaceTime on the phone. So they can see the event take place even though they're not there. And then when they can get there, then you have the big party and you celebrate. But your child is safe now, and having been baptized, you can still celebrate the baptism with the family after the fact, but you're not risking your child's eternal salvation by not having him or her baptized. You see?
Makes sense. I think I needed to hear one more perspective, because as of this morning, I was a little freaked out. I just felt like I wasn't fulfilling my responsibility as a parent.
Well, you sound like a wonderful mom. Is this your first baby, or do you have others?
Oh, it's our first baby.
Okay. Maybe you said that. I forgot. Well, yeah, that would be my heartfelt advice would be go forward, get the baby baptized. You know, if you're already registered in the parish and you let the priest know, or if he's convinced that you and your husband have been properly prepared and you know what you're doing, you could have your baby baptized at any time. It doesn't necessarily have to be scheduled at a mass, or I mean, after mass, typically. But okay. I would not delay, that's for sure.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. And again, congratulations. What a beautiful blessing. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Austin and talk to John. Good morning, John. John and Austin, welcome. All right, John and Austin's not ready. Let's go to Scott in Florida. Good morning, Scott.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I am well, thanks.
So I am calling because I was basically granted a miracle, if you will, by the Immaculate Conception, Our Lady of Lourdes.
Okay.
And the church that I belong to, coincidentally, is called Our Lady of Lourdes.
Okay.
So I approached, you know, the local diocese and the bishop about my story and what happened to me, and they kind of, you know, poo-pooed it from the beginning.
Okay.
You know, and they didn't seem to want anything that had to do with it or even, like, really learning about it.
Okay.
So my question, I guess, do I just let Providence and God do what Providence God does and just keep it to myself, or is it something that I should try to bring out more into the community and say, hey, in these dark times, let's not forget about Mary. You know, she's here. She's still working through us.
Did in your communication, I think you said with your bishop, did he prohibit you from talking about it, or did he just not express interest in knowing more about it?
Yeah, it was just an expression of not wanting to learn anything more about it and have a great day, basically.
Okay. Well, in that case, since he didn't prohibit you from talking about it, I don't see any reason why you couldn't share the experience with those around you. Did you submit the information to your pastor? Because he would be the first person to submit that to see if it should be run up the flagpole, so to speak. That might be a good step if you haven't done that yet.
Well, yeah, I actually did. And then that information was forwarded to the bishop.
I see. Okay. Well, then you took the appropriate step. You manifested this to your pastor, and he dealt with it that way. Then you got the answer from the bishop. So, yeah, I think your answer is the right answer. Just let Providence take its course. Now, you're convinced that it's a miracle, and it may be a miracle, but it also may not be a miracle. And one thing is for sure, there are plenty of people out there who claim to be seers and visionaries, and they claim all sorts of things, and it's not, in fact, true, although they may be convinced of it. So this could be genuine. And as you say, if you just rely on God's providence, if this is something that he desires to be known at a wider level, and it will be, then it will be known. And you'll be blessed for being patient and trusting, you know, trusting in God's providence and taking it from there. Now, it could be, too, Scott, and I'll have to leave it at this. If this is, in fact, an authentic miracle, maybe it's meant just for you. Maybe God in his wisdom desires that just for you, and it's not intended to be publicized. That's another distinct possibility. So I would just, you know, let it be and thank God for whatever it was that happened. Thank Our Lady for whatever it was that happened and move forward. And if there is an intention that it be made known more widely, then that will happen. That'd be my advice.
Okay, great. I totally understand that and I appreciate it.
You got it, Scott. Thank you. God bless you. Hey, we're going to take a break and we'll come right back. We have more yet to come on the Patrick Madrid Show this happy Monday morning. I'll be right back right after this. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Okay, we're back. Thank you for listening again. I sure appreciate it. All I ask from you is 3 hours of your life every day. That's all. That's all I ask. And thank you for giving it to me. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Christina in Central California. Hi, Christina.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, I bought a ring from an estate sale about a week ago, and a friend of mine told me that I should not wear it because I did not know where it came from or if it could bring bad spirits. And I want to know what your thoughts are about that. It says it's from 1921.
Tell me about the ring itself. What about it causes you to worry about this?
I didn't. I had no worries. In fact, I wore it for a few days. I was so happy with my little treasure find. And then she told me that, and I just thought, oh, my gosh, what if she's right?
And tell me again what she
said
about
the ring. Which I don't
believe
in that.
Tell me again what she said.
She just said that I shouldn't. She said I shouldn't wear it because I didn't know who it belonged to, and it could bring...
I see.
Bad spirit.
Okay, so first of all, it is true that an object can be infested with diabolical presence. It's true. You know, Jesus cast out the demons out of a man, and the demons asked Jesus to send them into a herd of swine nearby. You know that story, right? So whether it's a haunted house or devils going into swine or something, we know that this can happen. But did it happen here? And should you be worried about it? I don't think so. However, if it causes you concern, then I would take it to your parish priest and ask him to solemnly bless this ring for you. And he'll do that. And he'll bless it with holy water. And the blessing is intended to drive away any evil spirits that might in some way have association with this object. And then you'll be fine. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about, Christina. When the Catholic missionaries finally, and this was with Hernan Cortez, and his overthrow of the Aztec Empire in what is now Mexico City. I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with this story, right?
Correct.
At the center of Tenochtitlan, which was the name of the city in the middle of Lake Texcoco, which is now, of course, all underground. Mexico City covers it all. But at that time, at the center of Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, were a series of pyramids. And the main pyramid was the top of which, where they would sacrifice these hecatombs of victims. Men, women, and children by the tens of thousands. Sometimes this went on for weeks at a time, just the sacrificing of these people. And they had a temple built to the hummingbird god at the top of this pyramid. And so when the Spaniards conquered them, and you know, we don't have to get into the whole issue of colonialism and all that stuff, but just this pitched battle against the Aztecs. And when they finally won, you know what happened? The Catholic priests, they went up to the top of this pyramid and they completely cleansed it of all the blood in this temple. They threw out all these idols. They cleansed it of the blood. They cleaned it entirely out. They put a crucifix, an image of Jesus, on this formerly pagan altar, and they celebrated Mass. And so they, in essence, vanquished these evil spirits that were prompting these people to do such heinous things. So rather than just destroy it, they simply spiritually conquered it by planting the flag of Christ, so to speak, on this altar, and they celebrated Mass there and thereby hallowed it. So if that can be done with a bloodthirsty, pagan, diabolical religious rite, it certainly can be done with the ring that you got from an estate sale.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and appreciate your show.
You're most welcome, Christina. God bless you. Thank you. How about Darren in Texas? Hi, Darren. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. I was wondering if maybe you could clarify and elaborate on some advice you gave a caller a few weeks ago.
Sure.
She called in. She was having a husband that's a non-believer, and I think she was having difficulty getting her kids to Mass. And I'm in a similar situation. My wife and I disagree on every important point, abortion, transgender.
Oh, really?
Et cetera. Yeah. You know, living together before marriage. Anyway, it was 2 Corinthians 6, and it said, do not be mismated or misyoked with a non-believer. And you had given that advice to her. I was wondering, how would she actually act on something like that? I mean, there are other similar passages. Shake the dust from your sandals and move on. Don't give your swine, your pearls to swine, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly what did you mean by, when you quoted that to her?
Why don't I quote it now, just so that everybody understands the context of what you're referring to. So this is 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. Do not be mismated with unbelievers, for what partnership have righteousness and iniquity, or what fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial, or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. As God said, I will live in them and move among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from them and be separated from them, says the Lord, and touch nothing unclean. Then I will welcome you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. So there in context is the whole quote. So I guess my question to you then would be, the woman you're married to, is she a baptized Catholic?
No.
Is she baptized at all?
No. We did have a dispensation from the bishop to be married in the Catholic Church, and the Catholic priest married us.
Okay, fair enough. So this then becomes a question of the validity of marriage. Now, validity is really the question here. Now, in the case of a marriage that is sacramental, that is where you both confer the sacrament of holy matrimony on each other. But that, of course, didn't happen because both parties need to be baptized in order for that to happen. So in this case, it's really a question of validity. And what St. Paul is saying here is essentially that if you're a Christian man and you're married to a pagan woman, then there's a problem. And so his point here is, I think, number one, don't seek out those marriages. So if you were a single Catholic guy and you're aware of these things now, what St. Paul is saying here is don't get married to somebody who doesn't share your faith in Jesus. Don't be mismatched, you know. And that's a pretty stern comment. It's not something that is warm and fuzzy, but he has a reason for saying that. And you're living through that reason right now, aren't you? Where you see that tension and the division. I'm sure you love her, but at the same time, it's probably not easy to live with a woman who's so diametrically opposed to your way of looking at life, right?
Correct. Yeah. Very difficult. I understand that context prior to marriage, and, you know, don't go out seeking that. But if you're already married to someone that's like that,
right,
how am I to take that? And I did call the church where we were married, and they said, well, you are recorded as a sacrament for the marriage. So,
well, no, it would be a marriage certificate, but it definitely would not be the sacrament of holy matrimony. If she wasn't baptized, then you can't have a sacrament if one party is not baptized. So maybe the parish secretary was a little confused when she told you that. I'm sure there's a certificate of marriage on file there.
There is,
but, okay, but it certainly is not a sacrament for the reason I just mentioned. So my suggestion, Darren, now I'm not here to try to break up your marriage. That's the last thing I want to do. So I'm not trying to encourage you to do that. But if it's gotten to the point where you feel like you need to investigate this, I would take it up with your pastor and ask him, you know, what are the appropriate steps, canon law-wise, to consider whether or not you would be free to leave this marriage. And that's something for the canon lawyers to discuss. But because you're dealing with somebody who's not baptized, there that changes things compared to how it would be if she was baptized. There'd be a different set of considerations.
Okay. Yeah, there's a little confusion there, so I do need to get that clarified, because my understanding was it was a sacrament and recorded as such, but maybe not. Mm-hmm.
Well, I can tell you for sure, if one party or the other is not baptized, there's definitely no sacrament. Because here's why. Because you conferred the sacrament of holy matrimony on each other. It's not the deacon, it's not the priest, it's the couple. They confer the sacrament on each other. And if one party isn't baptized, then he has no ability to confer a sacrament. He has no ability to receive a sacrament. So therefore,
is the marriage still valid? Sorry, is the marriage still valid in the eyes of the Catholic Church, even though it's not a sacrament? I mean,
well, that's where I don't have sufficient authority, let's say, to pronounce on that. That's something that's better left to the canon lawyers, and that's where your pastor can start that process to determine that. And I would do so. I mean, if you have any questions, I would do that. But the issue of validity is the question here. It's not a question of a sacrament. It's a question of the validity of the marriage.
Okay.
All
right. First,
hang in there.
In 1 Corinthians, Paul goes on to say, if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her.
Right.
So I found that interesting in the same, you know, different letter from Paul.
Right. And you notice he does provide, he says, but if this is impossible, then it is permissible. But the ideal would be to remain with her if it's possible to do so. Yeah. And, you know, one reason for that is because this is a missionary field for you. And you can be the one evangelizing her, and perhaps she will come to faith in Christ and be baptized. Mm. So
thank you.
Okay, Darren, I'll let you go, but thank you. I hope this is helpful. 888-914-9149. Do we have time? Let me see. Let's see if we can do this with Ginger in LeClaire, Iowa. Hi, Ginger.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Quick question. Do you know of maybe you've done an apologetics Bible study. Our church ladies are looking to do that, and I thought I'd start with you.
Yeah, an apologetics Bible study. I am aware of a couple really good ones, so it's not so much apologetics, but you'll find a little apologetics in there. That would be Jeff Caven's Great Adventure Bible Study Series. Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with Jeff Caven's.
Okay, well, he's the progenitor of the Great Adventure Bible Study, and it's very good, very popular. It's been around for a long time. And if you just look that up, just look up Jeff Caven's Great Adventure, you'll find it. Also, Catholic Scripture Study International is one that was started by Gail Buckley. And she is, her website, I should say, is, let's see, CSSprogram.org. I believe that's what it is.
Okay.
And then also, I just had the good pleasure of getting to know the lady who started Walking with Purpose, and that is a Catholic women's Bible study that I'm just now becoming aware of. And I had lunch with her at Franciscan University Defending the Faith. So at the team lunch, we were talking about this, and it sounds really, really good. So their website is walkingwithpurpose.com, and that's another option for you.
Okay. Awesome. Now, in my web search for such apologetics Bible study, I discovered it looks like a road show that you and Peter Kreist did at some point.
Oh,
are you still doing that?
We're not doing that any longer, but maybe tomorrow I could talk a little bit about that. That's the Envoy Institute Apologetics Academies. I've got to run, though. Thank you, Ginger. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
You know, the word is spreading around America. This is the go-to place if you've got a prayer and you want the whole country praying for it. So I invite people to join us every night for the Family Rosary Across America Live.
7 p.m. Central.
Bringing Christ to the world through the media.
Relevant Radio.